Right, there are two handouts that you should be aware of. U.S. strategic purpose, John F. Kennedy's position in 91, and a bit on Lyndon Johnson, and the second one on the early rationale by Kennedy before he became president, that is in the 50s. Those are fairly significant perception of U.S. strategic interests at the time. So I came back to haunt these people later. All right, this is lecture number 5, Geopolitics and Vietnamese Political Thinking, Geopolitics in Indochina's History. Last time we had the first two parts of this. This time, U.S. strategic purpose in Vietnam divided into two parts, 20th century developments, and the determinants of U.S. strategic interest. First, a bit about U.S. foreign policy thinking in the early years. It was, this is after World War, this last 50 years or so, after the end of World War II. It was very much a straight line continuation, an extension of the World War II strategic debate that went on between East and West, between MacArthur in the Pacific and Eisenhower and the British in Europe. It was the so-called Europe First policy. It had to do basically with allocation of resources and war materials and manpower. And the British and Eisenhower and the American military in Europe, London, of course, were demanding all the warehouse all they could get because they were going to invade the continent. MacArthur and the Navy in the Pacific were saying this is equally important and we're getting the short end of the stick here, and it was a kind of ongoing argument. The only obvious solution to this is a kind of compromise, but a compromise which, like most compromises, is not satisfactory to either party. Anyway, that kind of Europe first versus Asia first, in a sense, continued on after the war. Those out in the foreign policy field that were in Asia really felt that the Europeans were always getting the better end of this, that we were not giving the attention and the importance that we deserved. Most of the people on the desks and in the policy making in Washington, we felt, were European first people. They had served in Europe and they didn't know anything about Asia, and they didn't have much interest in it. anyway, that really even continues on to the present as a kind of given in American foreign policy. Second was this influence between idealism and realism in foreign policy. A real politique versus morality. Something the American policy people had argued since the beginning of the country. George Washington's farewell address expresses to avoid entangling alliances. The Monroe Doctrine is essentially the new world for new worlders, and not for Europeans. Woodrow Wilson's influence, highly idealistic, which gave way after Wilson to the great struggle between internationalism and isolationism. And we've seen that repeated ever since World War I, the struggle between should our policies be isolationistic or should they be internationalistic. There isn't any real answer to this. It's two rights, really, that are arguing. It's also in the intellectual and collegial community was a running debate and a great argument all through the years after World War II. Hans Morgenthau at Chicago, probably the main spokesman for realism, for French-style realpolitik, serving national interest in terms of national interest, and nothing else really counts. Versus, there was no really major spokesman that could match Morgenthau. There were a number of the so-called idealists at Harvard and at Cal and elsewhere who argued that you had to have a moral dimension, that this was an indigenous and American thinking. And so that is, wasn't totally argued, I think, denied by anyone. It was simply a question of the balance of how much you allocate to realpolitik, to national interest, how much you allocate to human rights, to civil rights, and so on. Really a kind of question of, I mean, the Americans do have a kind of idealistic impulse, and their foreign policy has always had this. It has not been characteristic of European foreign policy. And the French, for example, could never really understand what is giving us so much problem on this. Or the Germans, for that matter. But I think all foreign policy makers, secretaries of state and so on, have given allegiance to this principle. We must serve both of these masters. Kissinger, for example, would, when you went to work for him and you'd get a kind of basic briefing, I mean, I was working for him in policy planning, and there were a number of things on what he wanted me and the rest of us to do and not to bother doing. And he usually would come around in this briefing to this question of human rights or civic rights, as we called them then. He had what was generally regarded by his critics as a defensive policy or a delimited policy. Really three things that should concern us as foreign policy makers, and these are the instructions that go out to the ambassadors, and these are the ones that I expect them to follow. Three conditions. First, no torture in the country that you're in. You hear that the locals are torturing people, I want you to go in and pound the table and say there are things we can do that are nasty and you won't like them, and we're going to do them unless you knock this stuff off. It's not a bluff. I mean, you really have to be prepared to follow it up. But you have times where they just tell you to go spin, and there isn't much you can do. But even so, there are things you can do and make life hard for them. And generally, the notion of torture of people is simply unconscionable. It's not necessary. And we're not going to stand by idly as you do it. French doesn't bother them a bit. British, as far as they didn't care whether people are being tortured or not. Unless we leaned on them to lean on. The second was no prolonged incarceration. You've got this person in jail on resistance to the government. They've done something critical. They've opposed, they've demonstrated that. You've got them in jail, and there they stay week after week, month after month. And what we are to say to them, we would like to strongly urge them, we want you to put these people on trial. We know you've got a kangaroo court maybe out there, but the least you can do is find them guilty and sentence them. The prospect of a person languishing in jail month after month, year after year, is simply intolerable in the modern world. Third was the, what we call the cause célèbre. You've got a human rights violation in this country, an individual, almost always, and that individual has a lot of support around the world with Amnesty International and the other human rights groups. And so we say, solve that problem. Mainly, let the person out of jail, let him out of the country. We're dealing with the Chinese on this right now, some of their dissidents. And of course, the country involved that you're talking to, the foreign minister, says, listen, this guy is guilty. Guilty under our law. He got a fair trial. We sent him to jail, and that's where he belongs. And we say, yeah, we know that. But we're telling you that this is doing you an inestimable damage in the United States in public relations. Makes my job hard, makes your job hard. So we're just saying, adopt realpolitik attitude and let the guy go. The time I was in the State Department, the biggest trouble was in South Korea, over some of these Protestant ministers who were obviously guilty of breaking South Korean law, which all things were reasonably honest law. And of course, there was a huge movement, both in South Korea and in the U.S., to free about three or four of these individuals. So we leaned on the South Koreans, and they finally let the guy loose, and they went to Japan. One of them came to the U.S. And of course, they continued their hostility toward the regime. And then the Korean foreign minister would come back at us, and he said, "See, that's what happens." And we said, "We know that, sir. We could have predicted it. We knew it. You knew it. We all know it. You're better off with this guy around free in Japan condemning you than you are having him in the States." Because eventually, and that's what happened, the Japanese kind of got tired of him causing so much trouble, and they told him to quiet it down, or they'd ship him back to Korea. But it's a problem that you can't really solve. It's simply something that you have to live with if you're in the foreign policy field. Often it isn't all that big a problem, actually. All right, to return to the theme of strategic importance of Vietnam to the U.S., why is it important? Why has it been historically? Well, first in military terms, so this narrow military term, it's the geography that places Indochina on the Chinese frontier. Its ports and its air bases that make it of strategic importance, both with respect to the South China Seas and to the international sea lanes. Very important to Japan that you have potential. All the Japanese oil, for example, comes in from the Mideast and it has to go up that sea lane. There's a constant fear of the Japanese that the hostile power, if they really wanted to, could come out and cut this sea lane. Japan's oil would be cut off and they'd be in very deep trouble. Second, Indochina has an overland access from Vietnam to Laos and Cambodia. It's the pressures which Hanoi can put on all of Indochina. And has runs the prospect of doing this, of drawing in outside forces to try to do something about it, either the Chinese or the ASEANs or conceivably the Americans. Vietnam and Laos, the Indochina countries, confront Thailand across this long line, shallow of the Mekong River. It's a frontier that is virtually indefensible against massive attack by well-armed conventional forces. The Mekong is a long way from Thai ports. That's why Kennedy in 1961 made the decision to defend Thailand and the rest of Southeast Asia by seeking to neutralize Laos by diplomacy and by fighting the battle for Southeast Asia in Vietnam, as you saw. Thailand is ultimately critical in Southeast Asia because of its geographical relation to China on the one hand, Malaysia and Singapore on the other. A single major power controls all of Indochina and Thailand, the vital interests of India, Japan, the U.S., Indonesia, and Australia are in jeopardy. That's the rationale. That was the rationale in 1960 or so. And it's really why Carter and Reagan reaffirmed the applicability and the treaty commitments to Thailand. All right, so much for the U.S. military view. A bit of history on U.S. policy in Asia began as a simple concern for maintenance of trading access in the spaces in the face of special interests developed by the Western powers who were operating in the region. This was the coaling stations of the 19th century. What they really needed was places for steamships to put in and pick up coal. The ambiguities of the open door notes about the 1900 period of the U.S. State Department, Theodore Roosevelt's tilt toward the Russians in the 1905 Portsmouth Treaty in the wake of the Russo-Japanese War, a strategic dimension to U.S. policy emerged, parallel to the one that emerged in World War II and World War I in Europe, namely that the U.S. interest and a balance of power be maintained in Asia, as a balance of power should be maintained in Europe, that no single power should dominate the region. A power with hegemony in Asia would command the resources to expel the U.S. naval power in the Pacific, back to Hawaii at least, was just as hegemonic a power as Europe could dominate the Atlantic, like the German submarines came to demonstrating both in World War I and World War II. So the U.S. acted systematically on that principle for 100 years. When a balance of power in Asia seemed real and present danger, this policy would bring us into confrontation, and did. It brought us into confrontation in 100 years with Japan, China, and Russia, with their surrogates, and at times it has brought us into association with Japan, China, and Russia. So the consistent view throughout has been that Southeast Asia is a critical in the balance of power in Asia because of its relation to the sea routes and the exercise of sea and air power, because of its resources, and because of its location with respect to geological and geopolitical relations with respect to China, India, and Japan. This had a special meaning as an area of forward defense of the Pacific for the U.S., which was vividly demonstrated by the loss of the Philippines to Japan in 1942. But for the victory at the Battle of Midway, it might have been at best that we would have been able to hold Hawaii. In addition, the U.S. shares a significant degree of interest in other Southeast Asian allies, whose security would be threatened by any hegemonistic single power. It's essentially a negative interest that is satisfied. All the presidents, from Roosevelt to Clinton, have stated the basic principle that we must have an independent, hopefully neutral, at best, Southeast Asia. American strategic interest in Vietnam and Indochina in the decade after World War II was minimal, certainly when set against the interests of Western Europe and the vital task there of reconstruction. France was crucial within Western Europe. American policies were of necessity, conditioned by the need for harmonious relations with France. When American leaders were obliged, as they occasionally were, choose between serving American interests in Indochina or serving them in France in Europe, the choice was not regarded as a particularly difficult one. It serves the French in Europe. This is the Lost Revolution thesis by my friend, the late Robert Chaplin, a book by that name, The Lost Revolution, which argued, and he argued with me all through the Vietnam War, we should have backed Ho Chi Minh and the revolutionaries in Indochina and not have backed the French. And while I argued that, you know, that may be true and my history may prove it, it was an unrealistic policy suggestion. You just couldn't do this in a Eurocentric Washington. Say, well, let's to hell with the French, let's, and the EDC, and communist takeover of France, and then all this factors, to back this guy out in the jungle named Ho Chi something. He may be right, historian, but would be a paper you could do something. Maybe we should have been it was a more plausible thesis when the Cold War was still going on. Now I don't think it holds too much water. There's no question, though, that there was a Eurocentric basis of America's Indochina policy right from the start. Much of the impetus for getting involved in Indochina after World War II was Eurocentric. We were in China, or in Indochina, to move France, back in France, as a government to the right, to cool anti-Americanism in France, and to weaken the position of the French Communist Party. And it is worth noting that the French Communist Party was as nationalistic and anti-Marxist as any of the right-wing movements in France could. Everybody in France, virtually, wanted to keep Indochina. It is our heritage, it's a French civilizing mission, and the French Communist Party, which at one point had a couple of members in the cabinet and was on the way to becoming elected, they thought, they hoped, as the government of France, did nothing to oppose colonialism. In fact, they supported it even more strongly, but it wasn't all that apparent at the time. There's been a couple of books since on it, which even sort of shocked me how bellicose French Communist Party were on the whole notion of the solidarity of the workers of the world. This went out the window. It didn't. You didn't have this in Marxist parties in other countries. Anyway, our policy was consistently Eurocentric, sometimes to the despair of the people in the State Department, the experts in the Far East, who argued that we were paying much higher price for supporting France, much higher price than we needed to pay in Indochina, and that it probably wasn't going to work anyway. France was only the only country, really, colonial country in Asia that really thought they could restore colonialism after World War II. Nobody else really. The British didn't believe it. They had a plan to get out of India, Malaya, Burma, Dutch out of Indonesia. The Americans had already granted freedom during World War II to the Filipinos. There was no question of our going back. The Portuguese, only the French, really felt this place belonged to us. Admiral D'Argelot gets off the plane in 1945, says we have come to reclaim our heritage. And he and the colons in France, really, I'll go into this much later, where I feel that they sabotaged the French foreign policymakers of Paris, the Cato slave people. Government was very weak that time. There was one government after another in that whole period. They'd form one and it would fall. Another one would take over, try to do something, it would fall. joke around the State Department was that the French gave us the Statue of Liberty. We should give them the Empire State Building, which could be a clubhouse for former French foreign ministers. In broader terms, I think American strategic thinking in this period, throughout the world, as well as in Indochina, that it was a product of the trauma of World War II and the events leading up to it, is often commonly called the Munich syndrome. Essentially, it is the belief that aggression could not be appeased. Once it's on the march, it must be stopped by force. And stopped sooner rather than later, because the later, the higher the cost. Such was the lesson of World War II, American leaders believed. Because of it, we fought the Korean War, and it was very much instrumental in decisions to go into Vietnam and subsequently. It remains the kind of influential doctrine, it was really the rationale for the Gulf War. But there was a shift here internally between 1950 and 1954. from the U.S. being in Vietnam for the sake of France, and Vietnam, or the U.S. being in Vietnam for the sake of Asia. This is an influence of the developments there. Fall of China, the communism, Korean War, and the success of the Marshall Plan, which was our plan to stop communism in Europe. With the success of rebuilding of Europe under the Marshall Plan, Europe still counted, but it was not as worrisome as it had been. During the Viet Minh War, 1946 to 54, a difference of opinion arose among American leaders as to whether the Viet Minh represented totalitarian aggression, and therefore was the Munich syndrome applicable. Some argued that it did not represent. A lot of the French also said this. It is not a strategic threat to the United States. It's not a totalitarian aggression. It's an agrarian reformer, basically. Anti-colonial. With a particular strategy, but not one that was applicable to the Munich syndrome. There was, however, I think, no difference of opinion that you cannot replace something with nothing in geopolitics. Geopolitical vacuum is in nobody's interest. So there is a strong consensus in Washington that a strategic vacuum in Indochina was distinctly not in American interest. And hence there was a need for American policies to prevent disequilibrium or national disintegration. We hope in Indochina that someone else, the French perhaps, would hold the line. And through continued French presence and influence would come stability. Largely, but not entirely, American leaders believed the French could not do this by military means. Rather, the French should work for accommodation of the sort that the British were achieving in India, or the Dutch in Indonesia. And American estimates of French prospects during this period, during the Viet Minh War, veered constantly toward the pessimistic. Little faith was held in the overly modest proposals, diplomatic proposals, by the French, and even less hope was held on the fortunes of the Indochina French Expeditionary Force, mostly mercenary French and local Vietnamese. As I say, colonialism really was dead in Asia. Everyone seemed to recognize it, not except the French. But in actual policy, the U.S. went along with whatever the French government sought to do in Indochina, regarding its acquiescence as part of the price for assuring the success of the Marshall Plan. That said, the opinion of some of this policy sacrificed essential national interest in Asia, our national interest, without actually enhancing our policy in Europe. Perhaps that will be the ultimate judgment of history. At any point, I think, as I would have said to Chaplin, you couldn't expect the Truman government to favor Ho Chi Minh over the French. There was a time, a sort of a point of no return on this in mid-54, on the run-up of the Dien Bien Phu battle, when the French apparently asked us to intervene militarily, asked us apparently to use the bomb, and this was rejected. Exactly. Apparently some American military were in favor of this. Eisenhower, the president, was not. It never came to much, but there's a good deal of literature on this. The day that we didn't go to war. There's a series of articles in the Washington Post at this time. It tells you everything you need to know about it. All right, out of the confused ending of the Viet Minh War came a redefined statement, a residual belief of American strategic interest in Indochina. It was that some force, not France, but America, must do what is necessary to maintain stability and equilibrium, prevent it from devolving into chaos, anarchy, and a strategic vacuum. This was seen and cast as a high sense of American responsibility. It could and was also expressed in terms of narrow national interests, either the idealistic or realistic. Could be viewed as a means of halting the spread of communism or as enlightened internationalism. So it could, and the handouts you got, especially the ones by Kennedy, capture the spirit of this very much. So it could and did enjoy the support of virtually all influential Americans, particularly intellectuals, liberals, and the young. A sense of this special responsibility exhibited very early by a young senator in 1957 who became president of the United States. He got one place too. All right, a bit about the other side of the coin, the communist strategic interest in Indochina. Insofar as there was much monolithism of thought among the Soviets, the Chinese, and the Vietnamese communists concerning the strategic importance of Indochina, it was that the area should be taken out of the hands of those Indochinese peoples and others who were hostile to communism. Increasingly, this came to be defined as hostility toward the respective nation state rather than hostility toward communism as an ideology. Initially, Marxist theories on geopolitics had wider acceptance. A greater unanimity of view prevailed. General attitude reached by the end of the Vietnam War was that the communist forces in the region had forged a new, highly successful strategy which held promise for communist power seekers everywhere. That's the grand strategy known as Revolutionary War. Lectures 15 and 16 in late October will deal with this in the nature of it in some detail. The rise of the concept of Revolutionary War generated unusual strategic interest in Indochina. The Vietnamese and the Chinese enthusiasm for the creation was understandable. It had delivered mainland China to the Chinese communists. It had enabled the Viet Minh to expel the French. USSR, despite more measured enthusiasm for the Revolutionary War, still found it useful to help advance the frontiers of Asian communism and as a strategic device to buy time pending the development of a Soviet thermal and nuclear capability. Thus, Indochina in the 1945-55 decade was strategically important to the communists, less for its inherent self than for what was going on there. First to defect from this idea was the Soviets, whose loss of enthusiasm for Revolutionary War correlated highly with its nuclear weapon production curve. Revolutionary War might be a device to stop the American imperialism if you don't have the bomb, but once you get the bomb, then it's not as important. The cooling of enthusiasm by the Chinese communists can be dated actually from September of 65, the publication of Lin Piao's Long Live the People's War. The difference of opinion to whom Lin Piao was speaking, some specialists say he was talking to the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. And I would say I read this as a Viet Cong cadre would read it, and I think he is indeed saying that that we, the Viet Cong structure, is inadequate. Its conceptual framework is wrong. Its military strategy inappropriate. It's violating all the principles of people's war as it was interpreted by Mao Zedong. There's still a kind of open debate among the Chinese. I'm not sure. Well, Well, mixed in with this in Beijing was Mao Zedong's thinking about the bomb, the use of nuclear weapons. We don't need them, he said, because man is a spiritual atom bomb. Be read, don't be expert, he said. So that attitude obtained until China got the bomb, and then it dropped references to the fact that we don't need it. So China may have lost strategic interest in Vietnam as a model of revolutionary warfare. It retained a kind of ancient, uniquely Middle Kingdom interest in suzerainty, an integral part of its worldview. The view that China is the Middle Kingdom, there's heaven and hell, and in between is the Middle Kingdom, and all around it are the barbarians, all of everybody that is a Chinese. And one main problem is the barbarians don't realize they're barbarians. If they did realize it, they would pay deference to the Middle Kingdom. And most of them actually through history did pay deference to China. As late as 1870, the court in Wei would once a year send a lacquered box with a single gold coin in it to the emperor in Beijing. It was this act of deference that was important to the Chinese. People around Andrew, my son in Hong Kong, was about four, all the drivers and so on, taught him this phrase, here comes the barbarian. So every time I would come home, he would say this in Chinese, here comes the barbarian. I said, you know what a barbarian is? No. I said, well, you're one too, so I guess we're not Chinese. Anyway, out of this has gone this hegemonistic belief, I mentioned it earlier, China has an inherent right to monitor the destinies of the peoples on its perimeter. And barbarians so arranged there have an obligation to deference. Well, one other dimension here relevant to the whole geopolitical scene is the Sino-Soviet dispute. This began in the 1950s, but it didn't really surface, that is, we didn't really know about it until much later. We now have historical evidence that it began really in the, maybe as late as Mao Zedong, was told people much later. It began in about 1948 or 49. But anyway, this struggle for leadership between Russia and China and geopolitical differences and fears of each other, all involved in their strategic thinking, sort of came to dominate Russian and Chinese thinking about Indochina. Overall effect of this was twofold. First, it made Vietnam and Indochina far less important in the general scheme of things, prime importance being reserved for the dispute itself. I can remember interviewing cadres from the north who would tell me that, so what about the Sino-Soviet dispute? The contradictions of communism, of course, you took and before you came down. Did you have this? Yeah, yes, they told us. What did they tell you? Well, mostly that the Chinese were right and the Russians were wrong. I said, very consistent. Now, how do you feel about it? Well, it makes me very angry that the dispute goes on, that they allow it to go on. Here we are at the forefront of revolution, and what these people really care about is their own argument with each other. I guess that's understandable. Anyway, it was a kind of plague in both your parties. It was not a desire, as far as I could tell, and I think this went all the way to the poet, Jerome Hanoi, to side with either the Chinese or the Russians on it. Ho, when he was alive, tried to adjudicate it without much success. Mostly, the use of this was to what Bernie Faure called the zigzag policy. They sort of lean public statements or actions toward the Russians, and the Chinese would get their backs up, and then they'd zig it the other way. zigzag back and forth, signing nuclear test ban treaties or public statements, that sort of thing. Anyway, the first point is that this did come to dominate both the Russian and Chinese thinking about Indochina. Second was, quite ironically, that it entrapped both Moscow and Beijing more deeply in the affairs and the fortunes of the Indo-Chinese Communist movement than otherwise would have been the case. Neither of them could afford a kind of standoff, cool posture for it. And any time they tried to do this, any time one of them would try to, the other would immediately say, ah, they're selling us out, you guys out. All through the Nixon trip to China, for example, this was a Soviet charge, and our diplomatic efforts in Moscow to get the Russians to lean on the Chinese to settle the war were immediately seized, no matter how secret they were immediately publicized and seized by the Chinese in talking to the Vietnamese. You see, the Russians are going to sell you out. So, in this respect, I would say the Sino-Soviet dispute was most fortunate as far as the North Vietnamese are concerned. It gave them a maximum amount of freedom in decision-making by sharply reducing the control which either the Russians or the Chinese could yield. Normally, if you're supplying a lot of military hardware to that country, you have a certain restrictions. You can make calls and decisions. But in this case, it was... The net effect was to force both Moscow and China to support North Vietnam's cause lavishly and uncritically. And so the North Vietnamese found themselves in the enviable position of receiving from both parties a great deal of aid, along with a great deal of advice, and being able to take the aid and ignore the advice. Thus, I think at the end it came down to the two major powers found themselves furthering a situation that was not in the basic interest of either. Had there been no Sino-Soviet dispute and the two remained in agreement on fundamental matters for North Vietnam, this would not have enjoyed this freedom provided by the dispute. China was the one that became most disillusioned on this. After 73, in the American pullout, Mao told the German, West German ambassador to Mao to Beijing, you Americans obviously, although the American was trying, the Americans obviously were not serious about Vietnam. And they left the country with only 58,000 casualties. And the German ambassador told me that, said, well, you know, I thought that was a sardonic remark, and it wasn't sardonic at all. He meant it literally. 58,000 casualties? You know, that's nothing. And they're not willing to pay more than that. They were not serious about it. And of course, what was really sticking in his craw was, as Chinese told me later, we depended on you to keep two Vietnams. And here you pulled out, and you left us holding the bag. And, you know, we had to invade and teach these people a lesson. 79 invasion. And I think, as I told you, I said, where were you when we needed you? Anyway, it's an interesting subject how the Soviets and the Chinese viewed the strategic importance of Indochina, and how they went in a sort of complete circle. And the Chinese, I think it's fairly clear that China began, the Vietnam War went on so long, when China began, China was a regional power. And like all regional powers, they wanted foreigners out of the area. They wanted to be dominated by the people in the region, by themselves, if possible, by other locals. And so their whole interest was getting the Americans out, any way you can do it. They were ticked off with the Vietnamese for not fighting correctly, for not negotiating correctly, for doing everything wrong, in their view. But nevertheless, there was no difference of opinion on what to do. Then, in the process of the years went on, China moved from a regional power to a global power. And once it became a global power, a whole new set of national imperatives and strategic interests come into play. Mainly that you try to establish a balance of power or neutral versus balances on both sides. But in the whole region, nobody comes to dominate. You want the U.S. in there because they can offset other powers. You want the Russians. You want everybody in. You no longer want people out of the region. You want these forces in. So it's a natural development that happens, I think, in all strategic changes. It was very marked, I think, in the case of the Chinese, more so than the Russians. Well,